Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and CosmicPotatoNetwork.com.
From the historic Cosmic Potato Studios, welcome to That Star Trek Podcast.
Hello, this is Captain Tilly. What the hell? What the hell? Hold your horses!
This is your place for detailed analysis and speculation of all things Trek.
Besides, we've got the new uniforms.
And lovely uniforms they are, Captain.
Join us as we dive into the newest content coming available on CBS All Access, as well as retrospectives of the past series and films.
Discovery is our. Today will be her maiden voyage.
Now, on with the show.
Before we actually start talking about Star Trek, I wanted to mention a gripe that I noticed last night. We skipped all the Black Friday shopping. We did go to Walmart last night after the crowds had kind of died down to kind of try and get a few of the leftovers because they had some Sesame Street pajamas and stuff like that on sale for the baby. When you're buying merchandise that's licensed from The Mandalorian, there are other things in that show besides Baby Yoda. That's the only thing they market.
And it's the child.
Yeah, well, it's
the new episode.
They yeah.
Hang on. Are you up to date on The Mandalorian?
Yeah.
Stuff?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, there was people were getting upset because there was a Discovery video that came out right after it released, and in the title it was like what was it about? Oh yeah, Burna meeting her mom, and you know people are like, oh, just in the title of the video it's spoiling.
Stuff like that,
like,
really
that sucks.
They used to do that with The Walking Dead a lot, because the show would air in the Eastern time zone, and then they would ruin stuff for the people in the Western time zone, because they would post on Facebook, oh, RIP so-and-so died this week or whatever.
Like, yeah.
It hasn't even come out in California yet. All right. Let's see. Let me pull my notes up.
I tried to take notes on this show, and I couldn't. I was too enthralled watching it a second time.
Yeah. I have to write something down just so I can keep the... Just so I have somewhere to go, you know, or else we just wind up talking about... We'll be 30 minutes into our conversation, and we haven't really talked about anything yet. Hello, everyone, and welcome to That Star Trek Podcast. My name is Sean Ray. This is your unofficial place for all things Trek, and the only podcast that lets you know little tidbits of information, such as the fact that the Battle of Wolf 359 will take place in 2367, but you won't be able to watch it through a telescope on Earth until 2375. Tonight, we will be reviewing Star Trek Discovery Season 3, Episode 7, which was titled Unification 3, written by Kirsten Baer and directed by John Dudkowski. While grappling with the fallout of her recent actions and what her future might hold, Burnham agrees to represent the Federation in an intense debate about the release of politically sensitive but highly valuable Burn data. Joining me tonight on the program, we have some of the usual suspects and a guest, and they're all stuffed to the gills with turkey, dressing, stuffing, all of the above, and a sundry. We have Seth. How's it going, sir?
I'm doing pretty good. Stuffed with the turkey, the Romulan ale for this week as well. Cheers.
And we have Rick. How you doing, sir?
When did Phil Collins become a Romulan?
Was that really Phil Collins?
No.
I look alike. Scott, how you doing, sir?
Not many people may know this, but Admiral Vance was in one episode of Burn Notice. So there's cred.
I recognize him from things, but I have not studied.
He was in The Mummy.
There was also the first two entries in the Mummy trilogy, sure, but Burn Notice.
Well, this is some Burn connection right here.
Oh,
Eventually, we're going to find out what the burn data is, and there's going to be some deep dish and secrets on that admiral in there.
They're going to find Bruce Campbell.
The burn book.
Yeah, Bruce Campbell. And if you're watching on the video and you see this this blank avatar that says the shadow, that's John, and he may pop in from time to time. But all right, so I got to tell you, I'm pretty happy that this show is not doing the old standard of taking a week off for the holidays. It was really nice to have a brand new episode after we got done with Thanksgiving turkey. We got a brand new Discovery and a brand new Mandalorian this week, so that was pretty sweet.
And they both kicked ass.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which, this is not a Mandalorian show, but Ahsoka. She was awesome.
Yeah.
That's the first time we've ever seen a live-action Ahsoka, right? I'm correct with that, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Ahsoka, that's the first time...
Another cool character?
Yeah. I think that's the first time Ahsoka's been portrayed without... what's that? Ashley, the actress who's done her voice on Clone Wars, because she did her voice in the Rebels. The Skywalker little voice bit at the end there.
Oh, yep, that's right.
Yeah, I promise I won't take us too far down this rabbit hole, but when Rosario Dawson announced that she wanted to play Ahsoka, I was like, hell yeah. And then when they announced that she was going to play Ahsoka, I was even heller yeah. And then, bless you. And then a friend of mine was upset, or maybe it was you, Scott, that we were talking about it. Was it?
I wasn't upset about it. I thought it was a good idea from the jump.
Okay, I don't remember who. Maybe it was my friend Ted. Anyway, I didn't realize that the woman who voices Ahsoka in the animated versions is also an accomplished screen actor too, and she could have done the role. And there was a lot of people weren't upset that Dawson was doing it so much as they were upset that the woman who voiced her wasn't even considered. And I didn't realize, because a lot of times voice actors don't do on-screen stuff, so I just didn't make the connection.
May not have been the look they were going for. I mean, sometimes the character that they're voicing, they just don't look like that character or whatever. I don't know. I'm talking out of my butt here because I really don't know what she looks like.
But Dawson is a for lack of a better term, a box office draw. She's a name,
yeah.
So it's perfectly understandable they went that way.
Yeah,
and she was awesome.
Yeah, she pulled it off great. It was not one of those. Oh well, her name is recognizable and it brings in viewers. I just wish that she had been better at the role. I think she nailed it. And
yeah, it was good.
And then with the makeup and the prosthetics, I haven't watched a lot of Clone Wars and I haven't watched a lot of Rebels, just a little bit here and there. But I know what the character looked like in those shows, and they nailed it with this with that makeup design.
I wasn't even sure how much of that was how much of that was makeup and how much was just color correction, because when they do Gamora on the Guardians of the Galaxy, that's all color correction. It's not really green makeup.
It could be a mix of the two. I mean, if you look at some of the behind the scenes shots of, to bring it back to Star Trek, that the Star Trek Enterprise episode where they had the Orion slave girls on there, the actual behind the scenes shots, they've got the green makeup on, but it's really kind of poor and splotchy. And
yeah,
I think there's a nice combination probably of
it's hard to get makeup that, and it's color hard to get correction. that natural all the same color look that you're going for and keep it consistent.
I take exception to that. The Incredible Hulk looked fantastic on television. Long live Lou Ferrigno.
Yeah, except for the time that he fought the grizzly bear, and the grizzly bear had green makeup on.
Yeah.
All right. So I don't want to constantly say every week that each episode is my favorite, because this episode is not my favorite of the season, but it was the most interesting episode and the most fanboy in squeal inducing episode. It gave us the most information about the changes that have happened in the galaxy since the Discovery's time. They also pulled from Star Trek lore more than once, and they didn't pull from all the same place. You know, it could have been easy, with all the mentions of Spock, to just pull from TOS and from Unification, but there was pulls from Picard. There's pulls from all over the place in this entire episode. So, but we'll get into it. What, Rick, what did you think of the episode?
Well, first of all, okay, people have been giving me crap because I weep at all of this stuff. Okay, it's no secret that 9 years ago when my baby was born, it knocked something out of my brain and I cry at commercials if they're too sappy. but Star Trek being back on screen, I am absolutely unapologetic about how emotional I get over it. This episode had, but my wife is far more stoic about this stuff than I am. And we were both puddles on the couch watching this episode. And this was just one wonderful scene after another between Spock and Burnham's mom and all the throwbacks to TOS and TNG. And I love Discovery. It's no, you know, that's not a secret. That's not anything new. But this episode just really kicked it up a notch into, if they stopped it right now, if we got no more Discovery, I would be like, it ended good.
But what about the burn? What about you, Seth? What'd you think?
I'm similar to you, Rick, that I cry very easily now. In fact, at the end of this episode, I was kind of rolling my eyes thinking like, God, Discovery, they really cry a lot on the show as the tears are coming down my face. But this wasn't my favorite of the season. I liked it a lot. But up until this point, every episode had been my favorite. And so this one is just a notch below the last one or so. But they still did a great job of you know, connecting this whole story arc while still having a nice collected small story for this episode, which is something that they didn't do a ton of in the first season at all. Did better with last year and have been really doing good with this year. It's something I missed a lot. So I'm a big fan of this episode.
All right. Scott?
This is so far the episode that I've been looking forward to and anticipating the most of all of them. Partly because it was very strongly indicated that we were going to see what was happening with the Vulcans, probably with Romulans as well. But the main reason I've been looking forward to it is the title of the episode. The title set it up to be a third installment to a TNG two-parter, which is a great TNG two-parter. Sometimes they haven't always been Gambit awesome, but this one... the Unification two-parter was fantastic, and this turns it into a trilogy. Now, it's not exactly a true third part to that story, because that story was about the reunification movement between Vulcan and Romulus, and this is about Michael trying to talk her way into getting something that she wants that people don't want to give her. Surprise, surprise. It touched on it. It was... I would probably sooner call this Unification Epilogue rather than Unification 3. Having said that, I thought the episode was great. It had me ugly crying at least once the first time I watched it. And there were parts that I didn't necessarily love. I thought that the final, I guess the climactic scene, if you can call that a climax, because this episode was a lot of talking and not a whole lot of doing,
which doesn't get much more TNG than that.
fair play. But Michael's final monologue in front of the in front of that quorum was very Star Trek. That was a very Kirk speech, very Picard speech. But it was still effective. And it was yet another episode where I kind of knew how things were going to play out. A few episodes ago, when Michael and Giorgio went to the junk sale, I was like, okay, so they're going to kind of stall and talk their way around. Eventually, they're going to get out, and someone's probably going to get hurt on the way. And and still by the end they're going to make it out. No big surprise. On the seed ship. Okay, Nan's going to decide that she's going to stay behind so they can do what they need to do, and everyone's going to get home with what they need. No surprise.
We have to bring that up, Scott. I'm still burning and hurt from that.
I still think we're going to see, she's going to pull a Riker at the end of the season and come swooping in the seed ship and like plant something at the nick of time.
I think she's coming back for a minute.
Yeah, I don't know about swooping in and planting, but we'll probably see her again. But the way they resolve the episode specific conflict has not been a shock. They haven't really thrown us a lot of curveballs in that respect. But it's still wrapped up admirably, and Michael says her piece and everyone says no, like you expect. And then the one really important person decides to go around the quorum and give her what she wants, as you expect. So once again, Michael gets the most important information that everyone needs, and she's the hero, yet she still feels disconnected. I might be getting too deep into the plot, but there weren't a lot of surprises in the episode. But considering the fact that it was kind of what we expected, when they went for the emotional punches, it absolutely worked. And we can detail those as we get to them. But I think the most important thing, the one most important thing that should be said about this is I haven't been on the show for weeks, so I have been dying for my opportunity to tell you guys that y'all are crazy about this Voyager J. All right. It's not the same ship. It's not the same Voyager. It's a different Voyager. Yes, sure. Discovery is now Discovery A, and it's still technically the same ship as the original Discovery. Yes, the USS Enterprise, NCC 1701A, is technically the same as the 1701 because that was a refit. It was not a new ship.
No, 1701A was the Yorktown
the original Enterprise was destroyed in Star Trek 3.
1701A was a different ship.
Oh, wait a minute. That's right. My fault. A did not begin until 4.
The very end of 3, yeah.
This was a bad family moment.
It was the end of 4, that's right.
Because for some reason, I was envisioning A as starting from motion picture. My fault. My bad. I forgot that they introduced A after Search for Spock. But still.
Straight man.
Yeah, I'll get you straight. it's not the same ship. Yes, it's an Intrepid class. Yes, it's named Voyager. Yes, it's J, but it's not the same vessel.
It was an Intrepid class.
I did read somewhere that it was confirmed that is the 33rd century Intrepid class. I can't remember where I read this, but it was not a speculative, more of a, behind the scenes. And yeah, just to confirm, that's Intrepid. And it looks like an Intrepid class. It has the same general shape as the original Voyager, but it's not the same ship.
Yeah, but none of the other Enterprises were Constitution classes. So, well, anyway.
But they still have the same general saucer, neck.
Yeah.
Star drive and nacelles. And
B was an Excelsior class. C was an Ambassador. D was a Galaxy.
I'm not here to debate with you. This is a different Voyager is all I'm saying.
I'm showing off my starship knowledge. Damn it. Shut up.
I think it's got to be a different one, too. Just if I can throw my two.
I'm not going to argue that point anymore. But I'm just saying that when Prodigy starts and Janeway shows up in the Voyager A and it's a refit of the same ship, I'll drop my mic then. So,
you think that they're going to find a way to confirm on a children's show to confirm this is the same vessel that children's was in show. The Delta Quadrant?
They've been doing it on years. Star Wars with, I mean, yeah. Clone Wars is ostensibly a children's show at first.
two things that I want to mention that I thought of while you guys were talking. Number one, if Unification 1 and 2 were the Rocky series, then this would be Creed. And the other one that I wanted to... We've seen the refit of the Discovery for the last 2 weeks with detached nacelles, and the ship hasn't gotten to do anything yet. They haven't been in any kind of ship battles or anything like that to see what this new Discovery can do yet. John says This is his new favorite episode of the season. Not that anyone asked me.
Yeah, you know, the whole detach and sell thing, I, you know, honestly couldn't care less. But the statement that detached nacelles makes them more maneuverable.
Well, if the...
I mean, it's a thousand years in the future. We just got, I mean, who knows?
If the detached nacelles can turn in another direction from the ship and make the ship, like, go warp speed sideways or something like that, that would be pretty cool. But we'll see.
I don't know about warp speed sideways, but if they have... Now, yes, the nacelles are designed to generate the warp field that allows them to travel at warp, sure. But if they have incorporated any thrusters into the nacelles, then yeah, if the nacelles can independently change their direction, then it would allow for, let's say it would allow for easier strafing for the ship to travel in more of a sideways direction. They can fly more like Star Furies on Babylon 5.
Well, you'd actually be able to maneuver in warp, because I mean technically warp is like in a straight line. If you're going to turn, don't you have to like bring the ship almost out of warp, turn it, and then go back into warp or something like that? If your nacelles can move, then you could turn while you're still in warp.
I'll buy that.
Maybe so. I think that we've seen too often in other series ships that are traveling at warp and then they have to update their course, but they never make any sort of a point of, you know, drop out of warp, change course, and then re-engage at warp, whatever.
What does Paris say, though? Like, when you're in warp flight, no left or right? Tom Paris says that at some point.
Yeah, I was talking about that in, I mean, granted, there, I don't remember that, but it's been so long since I've gone all the way through Voyager, but I would imagine warp drive is probably, and this is, I'm going to use a carpentry reference because it's what I do. Warp drive is like a circular saw and sublight is like a jigsaw. You can make really minor corrections with the circular saw, but they're pretty much just a straight line. If you need to turn in any great, it's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. If you need to turn, you need to, and I have no idea where this analogy is going. I will say that you could totally be right, Scott. As far as I know, with my knowledge of ship design, and I realize this is probably the nerdiest, stupidest conversation most of you all have heard.
If they're tuning in, they're in for it.
Well, that's true. I mean, they should know us by now. The RCS system has all been on the main body of the ship. The nacelles are only for warp drive. But yeah, they may have changed that in a thousand years and upgraded Discovery with something. So I, you know.
So that black box that Michael recovered last week, this week they say it came from the USS Yelchin.
Yeah.
Which is very nice, pretty cool.
Yeah.
It's not the first time this season that a deceased Star Trek actor has been honored with a ship name. Hopefully it'll be something that continues. You know, we had the USS Nog.
But it is
Nog.
The first time that it's been mentioned, because we had to be told the USS Nog was there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Still, it's the second time this season I've cried at just the name of a spaceship. Just the name of one.
I didn't catch it the first time through, because when we first watch it, my wife and I watch it on the TV, and I don't have the subtitles on, so I didn't catch that she said the USS Yelchin. And then today, when I was rewatching it, and had the subtitles on.
Well, it's also nice to see Prime Universe. Like, we know that they've always embraced those the actors from those films as being Star Trek actors because they go to the conventions and stuff like that. But to hear it on screen, you know, acknowledging that, yes, we consider those actors to be Star Trek characters, you know. So.
Yeah.
And the third vessel that they were talking about, that they mentioned when they're talking about black boxes, was the USS Giacconi. Am I the only one that thinks that that was a nod to...
the composer?
To Kelvin Trilogy composer Michael Giacchino. It's just swapping two vowels and that's it.
Well, Giacconi is a famous astronomer.
Oh, well, then that probably makes more sense.
Something along those lines. I only know this because I read an article that called this out today.
The only reason I would have doubted it is that they don't generally play games with this stuff in this show. If they're going to do it, they're going to do it straight up.
Fair enough.
sometimes they'll name the starship just like whoever they're naming it after. It'll just be their last name. Sometimes it'll be their full name. Because like if you remember in that Deep Space Nine documentary, the eighth season that they were pitching was going to have the USS Emmett Till. So it would have had like that full name. And then sometimes they just name it like the USS Yelchin. It's not the USS Anton Yelchin or whatever, you know.
Well, there's precedent in you know our modern Navy. Isn't there a USS George W. Bush? Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that the
Theodore Roosevelt
on that have a shorthand for it, but the whole name of the ship is the George W. Bush, or maybe it's the George H. W. Bush. I don't know, but it's like the president's full name. It's not like
You have to make sure that we know which Bush they're naming it after. It's like with the Roosevelt. You can't call it the Roosevelt because you had two Roosevelts.
Right. And then let's not forget that the Stargate program had the USS George Hammond.
As they should.
Okay. One thing that the Expanse, a different show, does that I think I would like it if Star Trek does, they just make random names up, like the Agatha King, because, you know, history happens and there might be somebody worth getting a ship named after that you've never heard of because they become famous in 50 years or something.
Right. Yeah.
That would just be cool. It's always people we know.
In the first season of Discovery, during the Battle of the Binary Stars, we had the T'Plana Hoth, and I'm pretty sure there's been a Surok and I don't know if there was a T'Pau. So there were some Vulcan ships with names from Star Trek history, but further into the future.
The Shran class, I think, was it the USS Shran? Shran was involved in there somehow.
Yeah, there was a Shran
class. That's been something that's been criticized at Star Trek for a long time. It's like nobody listened to any music or read any books after the 19th century.
Yeah.
And I've been trying to work in the opposite direction. Past couple of days, I've been doing a search trying to find some Klingon music here in the modern day. I assumed that by now some people would have written music in the style of Klingon music.
There is a Klingon death metal band. I can't think of their name. Astovakor.
Now, but see, that's death metal, but they sing in Klingon. I want Klingon music. Like, what would
original?
Yeah, what would Worf be listening to? I would like to hear some of that.
Something that would give me a headache, I'm sure.
I discovered that someone wrote a Klingon opera. The title is Ooh. And it tells the story of the rise of Kalis, his battle against his battle against his brother Morath after Morath kills their father. His journey to the underworld, or to the afterlife, because at this point Stovakor does not exist. Helping his father and brother to regain their bodies, and then their fight against Molar, who helped Morath to seize control of the family house, and then the leader of the Klingon afterlife is swayed to Kalis' cause and fights at his side against Molar. Kalis meeting Lucara, them falling in love. Then the battle at, I can't remember where it was, that Kalis and Lucara.
Oh, Christ's sake, get your facts straight, man.
Krop Doom Grok.
No, it was not Klok de Kel Brok. It was a different one. And then their ultimate victory over Molar, after which Kalis commits ritual suicide, and the Klingon devil sort of decides to create Stovokor for the Honored Dead. This whole story is told in a straight up legit Klingon opera form, and it's been performed several times. This was back in 2010. It was written, and it had special engagement performances for like 3 years.
Wow.
Rick, you kind of suggested a couple weeks ago that you thought that the Vulcans were going to be the bad guys, and you were almost, I say you were almost right.
Say that again. I love hearing I was right about something.
No, I said you were almost right.
I'll
You said that you thought that the Vulcans were going to end up being the bad guys or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
They're not really the bad guys, but no. the Vulcans and the Romulans did reunify after the last time that we saw them, which would have been in Picard, I guess.
You know, the reason I prognosticated that the Vulcans were going to be the bad guys was because Alex Kurtzman said in an interview that, you know, and it was, it, you know, a while back that, you know, this season we're going to see old friends are no longer friends and old enemies are no longer enemies. So I was expecting Vulcans to be evil.
Yeah. The Vulcans and the Romulans have become one thing, and they are the Navarre. Even though it's obvious in that council meeting that we watched that they may be living together, but they're still not quite unified. You know, the Romulans are still. You know, that Romulan that was there, he's like, you know what? We'll give you the data whether they do it or not. You know, screw this. You know, I know we've been working on this for a few hundred years, but whatever.
Can I talk about really quickly about how deep people are, you know, the people that are complaining that the people making Discovery don't know their Trek. This was such a deep cut that I didn't even know about it. The word Navarre was originated in one of the, in a 1968 fanzine, which was probably the, if not the first, one of the first fanzines ever, called Spockinalia. And the woman who wrote the story, Dorothy Jones, invented the word Navarre as a Vulcan word to mean two forms. And then it got picked up in other fan fiction. This was like dozens of years before the term fan fiction even existed. When there was no internet, fanzines were literally mimeographed. Remember that, old folks? And then physically mailed to people, because Star Trek fan fiction started almost as soon as Star Trek did. And it was it was the first real show that ever inspired this. And you know, if you listen to shows like Mission Log or the Trek Geeks, there've been plenty of interviews with people that started the whole fan movement for Star Trek back in the 60s. And a lot of it started with them just writing these fanzines, you know, physically typing them. And then there weren't even Xerox machines, you know, Ditto machines. None of you guys are old enough to remember Dittos.
I am.
Really?
Yeah.
But, you know, they would print these up and then either distribute them at conventions or literally mail them to people. So, you know, their mailing list was maybe 60 or 70 people, or, you know, at its peak was, you know, 100 or so. But they had to physically make these, physically mail them using real postage and stuff. And that term was coined in one of the very first ones. And now it's canon.
Yeah.
It was used actually as a ship in Enterprise as well, as a Vulcan ship. It? Yeah. It's odd. I went to Google it on Memory Alpha, and it's a 404 missing page. But if you look back 2 days, it has all that info that you gave there. I thought I was...
I had to go to Memory Internet Beta to find it. Because
it's 404, right?
Maybe. Right. It was immediately after the episode.
Memory Alpha doesn't cover the books and the stories and stuff like that.
Yeah, Memory Beta is for more non-canon stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, I tried to find it for tonight because I saw it like right after the episode came out, and I don't even remember why. Somebody mentioned it on one of the Star Trek groups I'm on, and then I had to really dig to find the thing tonight. Because I thought it was, I couldn't remember exactly what the definition is, but it was two forms, and it was strictly a fan fiction thing until I guess Enterprise, and now
yeah, the 2002 Enterprise episode Shadows of Pajim, the
NX-01
encountered a Vulcan ship named the Navarre. So yeah. Okay. So.
I was a little bummed that he didn't even once mention the destruction of Romulus. That would have been kind of cool just to just to drop that.
Yeah, they also didn't mention anything about Spock's disappearance. They talked. They just they mentioned, you know, that this happened before his death. They didn't, even though it's his alleged death, because he technically he disappeared.
Yeah.
Okay. Remember, and we've had this discussion before on this show, but I have to keep pointing it out. This show is 930 years. All right, well, let's be generous and say 800 years after the events of the Romulan
the Hobus supernova.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So it makes sense that they know, because they're Starfleet, and they went, "Oh shit, this ship's from 1,000 years ago. We better give them some backstory." But the destruction of Romulus is beyond ancient history. You know, how many cities can you mention that were destroyed 1,000 years ago?
Yeah, now, but Grant, yeah, you know, Grant, but the they have a lot better record keeping than we do.
But still, all
and
right.
Because they have such good record keeping, but also the galaxy is a whole lot bigger than a planet. Yes, they have a record of it, but they have lots of records. How do you decide what to tell a ship that shows up from a millennia ago?
You know, and I know Istanbul was Constantinople, but I don't know why they changed it. That's nobody's business but the Turks, but still.
Oh, boy. I hate that song. Anyway, it's a matter of, okay, the Discovery has been around here in this century for a minute. We need to prioritize what it is they're going to know. They can't know everything right away. It's just, it's not practical.
Yeah, he also mentioned that you didn't know this in your time, but the Vulcans and the Romulans were actually related. They came from the same species or whatever. And it's like, you didn't mention that nobody in your time knew what a Romulan looked like, because they haven't been seen in 100 years or whatever.
But they wouldn't know that. That was, right. You know, that was a blip in a millennium. And Seth, I'm sorry if that sounded like I was jumping on you. I didn't mean.
No, it's actually, it's a good point, because you're right.
I've heard people saying that before. It's like, well, why didn't they bring it up? It's like, this is all fresh to us. And I'm sure that the crew of Discovery doesn't know that Romulus is gone.
My ears just heard the Kissat Cataract or whatever the names of the Romulan group was. And I was like, come on, you got to just mention after their planet blew up. But you're right. I mean, it was like 700 years, 800 years previous to that incident, even. They only mentioned Spock because it's like, oh, I'm his sister. And they're like, Yeah.
And I want to talk about Spock. I want to talk about Spock.
He would be like a celebrity in Vulcan history.
I want to talk about Spock, but I wanted to mention that when the Vulcan president was, when her hologram was on the bridge and Michael introduces herself, Michael says that Spock would find all of this fascinating.
Fascinating.
And as soon as she said fascinating, there was the sound effect of the old TOS style computer. And I mean, it was perfect. As soon as she said it, it was like, ding. So Michael invokes the T'Kal and Ket so that she can thoroughly argue for them to have access to the SB-19 data, which is a bunch of sensors scattered throughout the galaxy that's going to give them a kind of a three-dimensional look at what they're looking for as the origin of the burn and all that. Because everything that they found so far, they can kind of triangulate, but it's all two-dimensional, and they need three-dimensional.
That was kind of slightly frustrating, because even in the earliest Trek tech manuals, you know, navigation through space requires more than, you don't triangulate in space. You need at least six coordinates to find a point in space. And that would be like basic Starfleet Academy year one astrogation stuff.
Yeah.
Or if you watch Stargate.
Yeah.
Right. Six points for a location in three-dimensional space, plus a seventh point for a point of origin. That's what you need. But, you know, maybe they assumed that we, the audience, need to be informed. No, it's not that easy. You need more than that.
When they make the character that needs to be told that the one who shouldn't need to be told that.
Touche, but... Perhaps they didn't have the money to bring Tig Notaro on for this episode. She would have been a great person to have to explain that to. But
Tig Notaro. So Jet was not in this episode. Georgiou was not in this episode. Culber was not, and neither was Adira. Yeah. So
what bothered me about the scene with Vulcan President and the hologram on the bridge is she says, "No, you can't have this information." And without hesitation, Michael does exactly what she got demoted for, which is to take matters into her own hands, mm-hmm. not ask the boss, and just lob a diplomatic grenade into the middle of the room.
Yeah.
To force things to go the way she wants it to go. If they had just a couple lines, "Madam President, if you would excuse us for, if I may have just one moment," you mute the transmission and you go to the captain and say, "I can try this. This might help." And he can be a little bit wary about it, but, you know, after like a moment, give her permission, you know, try it. What do we have to lose? You know, we need to do this. Vance told us we have to do this. And then suggest the Talon Cat.
Not her MO. That's not how she does it.
Yeah,
he just needs to be captain.
Have you seen this show?
I know that they've established this as her character. That's why it bothers me, because she doesn't effing learn. She's a great character and she is portrayed very well, but it's annoying for them to keep going the same route. If she had stopped and if she had conferred with Saru and then proceeded to offer that challenge, I would have liked that better, because it shows that she is growing. She's actually learning. This is just a static progression of Michael's character doing the same thing that she's been doing all season, the same thing that got her in trouble, the same thing that got her tried for mutiny, just doing her own thing.
Yeah,
let her learn something. At least
John
once.
Made the point that she gets called on her BS a lot in this episode. So that's kind of setting her up to show that she's kind of a loose cannon.
Maybe this is some development for the crew around her right now.
Yeah. To start to realize how loose she can cannon. Yeah.
And that they have to call her on shit and they have to report her to the captain and tell the captain to tell the admiral, and you know.
That is fair enough. I do notice that in a lot of TV shows and a lot of movies, I am a bit more surface level than some other people. You know, I focus on how much I'm bothered by her not learning, but then I neglect to factor in the fact that by the end of the episode, she appears to be learning a little bit, mm-hmm. and that she was called out by everyone, including her own mother, in front of the entire class. Mom had to scold her.
And Tilly got promoted to first officer out of the whole thing.
Yeah, so
that's the kind of situation Saru wants to set up, you know, mm-hmm. tryouts a la Joker style.
Yeah, when Rick comes back, we'll discuss Tilly's promotion.
Yeah, we'll talk about that last. But I wanted to mention that Michael goes back to her quarters and watches a scene from The Next Generation on her DVR. I guess
how did he record that?
Yeah, this is from the logs of Jean-Luc Picard.
Oh yeah, that's
it's like do they have body cams on and they just record every conversation they have now? Because that was a private conversation.
From the classified archives of Admiral Jean-Luc Picard, which it was great just to hear that name.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was.
When Nimoy's face popped up, I was like, "Oh, look at that wonderful Vulcan face. I miss it." And then she hits play and he starts talking. I was like,
"Who recorded this?
Why am I..."
Something about his voice.
Leonard
Nimoy's voice is very, it feels like home, and just hearing him be Spock is very, it's very powerful, and it takes me kind of, not in a bad way, but almost out of whatever I'm doing, and I just get like in this room that just reverberates with his voice. I don't know. Maybe I'm weird.
I love watching TOS. The movies too, but TOS, Spock's voice, Leonard Nimoy's voice, was so distinctive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And any, you know, we've had a couple of really great portrayals of Spock other than Nimoy. You know, regardless of what I think about the Kelvin movies, I think the casting was awesome. I think Zach Quinto did as good a job as anyone could have done in that film as Spock. I think Ethan Peck was even better, but nobody can ever hit that vocal quality that Nimoy had, and I don't think anyone ever will. Because I just, the pronunciation, the timbre, the sound of his voice is just such, you know, I've been listening to it since I was 3 at least, and it's just, it's like a warm blanket wrapped around you. Mm-hmm. And hearing him again was the beginning of the tear fest that was this episode.
Yeah. John says I should let it go, call it a hologram, a recreation of his personal logs or whatever. But it's a tried and true technique of TV shows. Yeah, I mean, they did it in the pilot of The Next Generation. You know, when they picked up Riker, they had him basically watch the first half of the episode on a view screen.
Yeah, they did. That's right.
So
I always loved how Star Trek view screens are really good at like panning and zooming in
or weird angles.
Yeah, here, watch this this flight recorder of the adventure that we had before we picked you up, complete with dramatic camera angles and well timed
music
and well timed cuts to different angles and different cameras.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Yeah, I can let it go. It's not, it doesn't ruin it for me. I just find it kind of fun.
No, it was a great scene.
I'm okay I loved seeing him there. And even like in the Kelvin movies, when we at Beyond, when we saw that little picture of him, that was a picture of the cast from I think it was
five. Yeah, it was five.
Yeah, because it was right after they signed off at the end. Even that, which was obviously the cast picture.
That was even that, I was like, why was he carrying that picture around with him?
Yeah,
like, it's beautiful.
Did he pack a go bag in the jellyfish just in case he ended up being in an altar?
And why would he care about any of those other people?
All right,
but. The last thing to say about that recording, Sean, if this helps, is we know that it was his speech from the end of Unification Part 2, his explanation to Picard as to why he was remaining on Romulus. But it doesn't say specifically that was the exact same conversation that was being recorded. They might have been presenting it as a different conversation that he had card at some point in the unspecified future before he piloted the jellyfish. Who knows?
Yeah.
Doesn't matter.
I also want to we're closing in on 50 minutes. I have two or three other things I want to talk about real quick. First of all, so she's granted an advocate who is a member of the Kawat Malat. So that was a callback to Picard, and it was a great callback to bring mm-hmm. back the Kawat Malat, to not only know that they're still around 1,000 years later, nearly. I smiled just when I heard that name. I didn't know who they were going to be bringing in, but to find out that it's actually Michael's mother who has joined, you know, she's not a Romulan, but she's joined this group
But boy, did that make sense.
do we know how long she's been out here, though? How long she's been in the future? Like,
They didn't say how long she's been in the group. She doesn't look like she's aged a whole lot since the last time we saw her. So
she seems like she's changed a lot. It seems like it has to be a significant amount of time, like a year plus.
I laughed because it seems like, I guess once a season, we're going to have some masked figure come in and take their hood off, and it's going to be Michael's mother. Because that's the way we found her last season. She was the Red Angel. But yeah, when I saw that, when she took her hood off and it was her mother, I literally gasped. And I said, oh, it's her mom. So she finally
I cried just as hard tonight watching it for a second time as I did the first time. And I'm not ashamed of that at all. You know, my mom passed away 2 years before my daughter was born, and I know everyone loses their parents for the most part at some point, and I don't care. When Michael's mom showed up, bah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and especially at the end of the episode when she said, I've always wanted to be able to say to you, you're going to always know where to find me. Because she's going to be there. She's staying with the Kawat Malat. There was some question as to whether or not Michael would be leaving. She's decided that she's going to stay. Gabrielle also proves that her loyalty is more to her newfound family than it is necessarily to her old family, because she stands up against Michael at some point in this episode. She's giving it to her just as hard as anybody on that council.
Mm-hmm. But that's so, not new.
Oh yeah, yeah.
When she showed up as the Red Angel, she was just like, "All right, Michael, I'm going to kick you in the teeth a few times, and then I'm going back into time traveling."
He hasn't had to be a parent for very long.
This is tough love because you need it. Bye.
Yeah.
So in the end, they do give Michael the SB-19 data, and she's going to use it to try and figure out where the burn came from, how it happened. And in the meantime, Tilly is going to be the acting first officer.
I said it last week, and y'all were like, "No way."
Well, I still don't agree with it. I don't think
acting, it's a good choice. Right? It's acting.
Yeah.
And I think I can get behind it, and I can be okay with it if it never becomes permanent. If somebody else gets the job and she gets some good practice of being a pretend first officer.
Yeah.
I like Tilly. It just doesn't make any sense. Yeah, to put somebody with zero bridge experience as the first officer.
Right. When Saru said temporary, that helped me quite a bit.
Yeah.
And at the same time, when I realized, okay, they are placing Tilly as first officer, at first I was like, that seems kind of odd, because she's right. She's an ensign. She's making a really good point. And when you guys were talking about it previously, I was saying the same thing. It's possible, but I don't think it's a great idea, and it would be very unexpected. And it is, until right after it happened and I realized, well, story-wise, it may not make the most sense because she's an ensign and she is maybe not she doesn't necessarily have the constitution of a first officer, because she's very energetic and she has a lot of nervous energy. But then at the same time, I realized they've been telegraphing this since the second episode of the season. I should not be surprised.
Who else? I dig y'all saying that, you know, acting, but who are they going to replace her with?
Willa Nilsson.
It doesn't have to be anybody that's on the ship. I mean, personally, I think that the first officer of this ship needs to be someone from the 33rd century, because Saru needs to be able to have somebody that knows what in the world is going on and who all these people are.
Yeah, so someone that knows the terrain. And when you guys mentioned that in the previous episode, my first thought was Willa, because she's had...
Not in this episode,
mm-hmm. but she's had more face-to-face interaction with the crew than anyone else, save for Admiral Vance.
And she's been an asshole to every single person.
Yeah, the first asshole we've ever seen on Star Trek. Yeah, especially the first asshole to ever have any sort of authority. Captain Jellicoe. What's that? Sorry?
And did Jellicoe last more than two episodes? No.
Maybe the first officer.
Captain of the Enterprise? No, because they didn't lose their captain of the Enterprise. But he had still been a captain, and he returned to being a captain. And then if you read the books, he went on to become an admiral.
Maybe the first officer should be the emergency command hologram.
I'm predicting a field promotion for Tilly to commander.
I'm expecting a promotion for Tilly to lieutenant by the end of the season, as she returns to her science duties and someone else is installed as first officer. Maybe someone we haven't seen. If they don't send her back to the 23rd century, then maybe Philippa, because it looks like they're going to be changing her character this season.
Well, she's got her whole new show that she has to headline.
Well, who knows when that's actually going to be happening. They might push that off another season. They're making Prodigy. They're making Strange New Worlds. They're going to be making Picard season two. Mm-hmm. It would not surprise me if they push Section 31 another season out.
With it too, honestly.
And with, with the way they're doing out these plot lines in this season, I think it's going to be. I would not be surprised if season three of Discovery serves as a kind of a ramp up before jumping into season four with bigger plots that spin out from what's happening this season. It almost feels like they're using season three as a chance to, now that Discovery is in a different century, they're going to give us a season of prep as they acclimate to the 33rd century and the Federation acclimates to them. And they figure out, okay, this is what happened to the Federation. This is what brought the burn on. Now season four will be about restoring the Federation now that we know what the real problem is.
John says there's no way Saru would pick Philippa as first officer if you thought Michael was untrustworthy and unpredictable. Yeah, I just kind of think about what would happen. What if something happened in a battle and Saru were to get injured or killed, and then Tilly's in charge of the entire ship?
She's already done it.
Well, but that was all pretend.
I think Tilly's going to stay.
I think she's going to stay too. I don't think it's a good idea though. And I think everybody, because their ship is kind of like Voyager in that the crew is going to be the crew for a while. They're kind of an island. I think bringing somebody in from the 33rd century is a good idea. But beyond that, I think people would be disappointed if, you know, I mean, the only chance they're really ever going to get to kind of shake things up on the ship and get some promotions going, only the lowest ranking person gets it.
But everybody's cool with that. That's the thing. You know, that's the last scene that had me bawling my eyes out was the say yes scene in engineering.
Yeah, but it was.
But I could see the pain behind those smiles.
It was just like eight people from the crew.
Yeah,
and they were all hurt.
The senior bridge staff has no problem with it.
Yeah,
I guarantee that there are some lieutenant, maybe even lieutenant commanders somewhere else in the science department that are like, "What is this shit?"
I also laugh because Michael was already the first officer for a week. You know, but after all this time, Michael and Tilly are still sharing a room. Like the first officer doesn't even get their own quarters.
At least they're not sleeping in a hallway.
Yeah, that's true.
And I do want to say though, to John, the notion of Philippa becoming first officer occurred to me literally 4 seconds before I said it.
The only trivia that I had was, number one, the thing that Rick brought up about Navarre. Also, I wrote down that when Saru... I wrote this down. I think I've already mentioned it. But when Saru learns that the Romulans are sharing the planet formerly known as Vulcan, he says the Romulans were considered enemies in our time. Vance points out that history forgot this in your time, but Romulans and Vulcans were two tribes of the same race. All of this is true, but the funny thing is that because Disco's point of origin happens in 2258, that's a full 8 years before the events of Balance of Terror in 2266, in which Kirk, Spock, and pretty much everybody in Starfleet learned that the Romulans looked like Vulcans. Because in Balance of Terror, you know, that we see the Romulans and everybody turns and looks at Spock. Like
again, we're still expecting people in the 32nd century to have the firsthand knowledge of events from the 23rd and 24th century that we have.
Well, this Vance is supposed to be that character that has all this information for Discovery.
But it's a you know, 930 years, even with the best record keeping, nobody but a historian is going to know the minutia of a 50-year difference 1,000 years ago.
You guys noticed that we haven't heard.
Do you know when did New York become? When did New Amsterdam become New York?
In the 1600s.
Why do you keep going back to that They Might Be Giants song?
Because it's the only f-ing history thing I know.
So. Oh, okay. Well, Seth is going to figure it out. Well, here I will combat your how. It sounds like, Rick, what you're saying is, how can anyone be expected to know everything and be able to access that information you know, at a moment's notice.
Is that 1664?
Is that more or less what you're? Is that more or less what you're saying?
No, I'm not saying that because I can do that right now with this thing, and I'm sure Admiral Vance could do that at any time if it's necessary. But this was a conversation. This wasn't, excuse me, Admiral, when did the Vulcans and the Romulans know about each other? And then he would have gone. I'm saying that this piece of trivia you just got off of IMDb is people, and the trivia on IMDb is not from IMDb. It's people writing it in themselves. You know, it's
user submitted. It's user generated.
It's a wiki thing. And so you've got someone complaining that a man in the 32nd century doesn't know the specific details of when the Federation knew what Romulans looked like 940 years ago or 960 years ago, however long. I'm just saying, you know, it's the same thing as people griping when Tribbles are introduced in an episode and they're like, you know, oh, we know Tribbles. And they're like, but the Federation didn't know about Tribbles beforehand? No, the Enterprise crew didn't know about Tribbles beforehand. They keep looking at this stuff with such a microscopic lens, and it drives me nuts, clearly. And I apologize for getting so worked up about this. But it's like, you know, we have, there are over 700 hours of Star Trek. And I know I've said this before, so if you've heard me bitch about this in the past, I apologize. There are 700 hours of Star Trek that covers, what, 200 years of Federation history? So...
like 1,000.
Well, now it's 1,000, yeah. You know, we're looking at little pinpoint moments from the everyday lives of these people. And I forwarded something that I found online today where it's like, it's a meme. This is, you know, Saru sits down on the bridge and then websites lose their shit because he didn't sit down in a way that Roddenberry would have approved of, or Geordi, it violates a line Geordi threw away in season 5. You know, it was like, that's what we keep getting. And I know I've been guilty of this in the past and I've gotten over it. Yeah, I can't let it go. I know.
I wasn't saying that this was an error. I was just pointing out.
But I keep seeing this stuff. I keep seeing this stuff, and it's like, no, of course, someone 930 years in the future isn't going to know exactly when the Romulan War ended because it ain't beyond ancient history.
Well, you're not going to think about it. If somebody says they're from 1500 visiting America, you'll be like, oh, New York, right? You got to really think, like you were saying with your New Amsterdam thing. Like, well, when was that? 1660? And who's going to be considering that? But then again, it's just how we use that stuff. Like, I kind of love the little errors like that. But I find it fun. And it's just a way to kind of explore the fandom versus sort of battle.
The fact that we're podcasting about this every week, I can't watch this stuff without seeing it because it's like that Ephraim and Dot cartoon that we watched and they showed the Enterprise A exploding over the planet. And like, and they apologized. What? Come on. That's not right.
Screwed up and they apologize.
I know. That's a big screw up to release. Oh, and they're probably watching it as we're watching it. Oh, crap. We blew up the wrong ship.
Well, look, we had this conversation not 30 minutes ago about getting the wrong ship.
Which wrong?
Oh, crap. We left a guy in a t-shirt and jeans visible in the corridor.
Oh, yeah.
Which has already been fixed.
Yeah.
As I said on Facebook, they'll have him digitally removed for the special edition or, you know, in a week.
Yeah.
Five days later, he's been removed. That's a bummer.
I liked having that stuff in there in the old days.
That's the thing about streaming stuff. You can go back and fix it and just replace the file like that. It's like, oh, Discovery's down for like an hour and then it's back and it's a whole new thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the nice thing about digital is you can fix stuff like that. Yeah. You know, and when the internet loses its mind because there's a Starbucks cup on the set, you laugh and you move on.
Just like when you release a movie and the cats all have buttholes and you need to go back and take them out.
My wife was we were talking about this earlier because she bakes. She likes to bake. And so she was looking through Black Friday sales today, or yesterday. Well, it was today. But cookie cutters. And she's like, why are there so many animal butt cookie cutters? Why are people so obsessed with animal butts? And one of them was a cat butt, and it had a little X for the cat butthole. What the hell, people?
I saw that too. And I've been wondering.
You guys have anything else you want to add before we close things out?
I really need a Valium.
Yes, I agree. There are too many fans out there who have unrealistic expectations for how much characters should know and for how much the show creators and writers should think that the characters should know. And
sorry,
I agree. It's annoying when they make a big fuss about, but see, in this particular episode, this happened, so this person shouldn't know that, or they should know this. I get not as annoyed as Rick, but I do get annoyed by it. What I do, and see, this is me trying to offer a service, Rick, trying to help. When I see that happen, instead of focusing on what the losers are saying, because they're being too critical and their expectations are too high, I simply hear what they have to say, look at it as an opportunity for me to create some headcanon, which I enjoy doing, and then I move on with my day.
Hey, Seth, thanks for being here tonight.
Thanks for having me, guys. That's really been a fun. I see your name's been changed to Cat Butt, Sean.
By the way, I'm just speaking of names. I don't expect anyone but Sean to recognize what I put down as my name tonight.
Hang on, let me
Sean, do you get that? Sean, no, Scott. Not Sean. Scott.
I've been trying to figure it out.
I read it a few times. It doesn't. Diftor Hesmusa.
It's live long and prosper in Vulcan.
Oh.
Peace and long life.
I've never learned enough Vulcan to recognize it.
I haven't either, and when I looked it up tonight, I realized that we have all heard it. It's from Star Trek the Motion Picture.
At the beginning.
I haven't watched that movie in decades. Rick, thanks for being here.
Thank you. Can't find me right now. So don't...
tell everybody where I can find you.
My website does not exist at this point in time, and depending on when you're listening to it, that may not be correct still, but it will be back soon in a really cool way.
All right. And Scott, what about you? Where can people find you?
You can technically still find me on the Prime Direction, which, you know, it exists. Don't know when the next episode is coming out, but, you know, keep watching. Something will happen eventually. aside from the Prime Direction, which is findable on Facebook at the Prime Direction Facebook group or on Twitter at Prime Direct Pod. You can also find me on various shows here on the Cosmic Potato Network, including this one, sometimes on Cosmic Potatoes, sometimes on Captain Game Show. And if you're tired of listening to my voice, but you like seeing cool stuff with your eyes, then you can check out some of my graphic artwork, which is available on Twitter at Planet Rise, as you, my username right here in this video stream. Or you can visit my website direct, www.planetrisecreative.com. We are recording this episode on Saturday, November 28th, which means tomorrow, Sunday, November 29th, will be day one of this year's Star Trek Advent Calendar, where I will be releasing one themed image per day on Twitter and hopefully on my website, if I can stick with it enough to update both of them, which is such a chore. So watch Twitter, watch Facebook, and watch the website. There will be a new image released every day from now until the end of the Advent season for a full 2021 Advent set. Add it to your 2020 Advent set. Add it to your 2019 Advent set, which I'm sure that you printed out and framed and hung up last year.
And you know, Scott's huge in Germany.
In fact,
even bigger in Japan.
It took me a second to realize what Rick was saying. Yes, I was on Facebook. I'll keep this brief, Sean. I was on Facebook the other day, and everyone knows how Facebook will hit you with a line of profiles. Say, here's suggestions, people you may know. Here, be friends with them. And I'm flipping through that, and I see a Facebook profile for someone I've never heard of. It's a German name because they live in Germany, and their Facebook profile picture, I made it. The centerpiece of their profile picture was some of my Star Trek graphic artwork. And you know, I'm not mad about it. First thing my brother said,
congratulations.
My brother said, so cease and desist time. I'm like, hell no. They're not making money off of this, and it's spreading my work overseas. Come on, man.
Yeah.
Bring it on. Let's do more of it. I still get a thrill every time I go on Twitter and I see someone, or anytime I see the Twitter account for Rene Auberginois. Even when he was still alive, it was being run by his fans. He wasn't actually running it. He would contribute to it every now and again, but it started out as a fan Twitter account, and then he adopted it as official and let them continue to do it. And then when he passed, the people who were running that Twitter account saw the memorial image that I posted for him and asked if they could use it. So, you know, I signed a release and I gave him permission, and now my graphic artwork is the official avatar for Rene Auberginois' posthumous Twitter account.
Oh, that's cool.
That's cool. That's really cool.
I want to remind everyone that we have the 12 Days of Christmas coming up over on the Cosmic Potato feed. So if you're not a subscriber to Cosmic Potato, the Super Fan Talk podcast, go ahead and do that. We will be releasing a bonus episode every day from December 14th until Christmas Day. We'll be talking about Christmas memories, movies, TV episodes, the existence of God. Just subscribe. Rick, you were there. And the video version of those episodes will be on our YouTube channel. So,
and tell them about the ultimate sacrifice we're doing for you people out there.
Oh, yeah. On December 19th, we will have a live stream.
That's not a sacrifice. It's a privilege.
Yeah, on the Cosmic Potato Facebook page. And we're going to be watching the Star Wars Holiday Special, the original one, not the new one.
Oh, yeah.
And it'll be live streamed on Facebook. You'll be able to watch the movie on Facebook Live. You'll be able to watch us watch the movie on our live stream. So stay tuned. Check that out. That'll be December the 19th, and it'll be released as a podcast the following day. So
that's
going to pretty much do it for us this week. We'll be back next week to talk about the next episode of Star Trek Discovery, which is titled The Sanctuary. Until then, live long and prosper.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of That Star Trek Podcast. You can contact us on Facebook and Twitter, or you can send us an email at thatstartrekpodcast@gmail.com. Help the show grow by giving us a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcatcher. This program is not affiliated with CBS or Paramount Pictures. No infringement of copyrighted material is intended. Be sure to join us again next time on That Star Trek Podcast, right here at CosmicPotatoNetwork.com.